All right, so this week we're going to start with the cardiovascular system. So last week we talked a lot about your diuretics and we talked about how those affect your blood pressure, and they do so by controlling your fluid volume. And so we're going to talk about some different ways this week. So the first group of medications that we want to talk about is your angiotensin converting enzymes. And the ones that I want you to focus on, captopril is going to be your prototype, but I also would like you to be familiar with the root pril. So that's going to be your enalapril, lisinopril, rampopril, benazepril, prils. Now, there is one that does not fall into the prial, and it is enalaprilate, which is still has the prial in there, but it doesn't end in the prial. So just know that your prials are going to be your ACE inhibitors. And so what your ACE inhibitors do is inhibit the production of angiotensin 2 by blocking the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. They also increase the levels of bradykinin, which leads to the vasodilatation as well as excretion of sodium and water. And so your ACE inhibitors are going to basically create, it's going to work within the RAS. Remember, we talked about the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. And so the way it's working is it's encouraging the body to release both sodium and water, and it does so by this blocking the conversion of the angiotensin 2. It is used in the treatment of primary hypertension, congestive heart failure, MI, nephropathy, and then your rampopril reduces the risk for cardiovascular events, usually more heart attacks, strokes, things like that. So lisinopril is going to be a very common one that you're going to see frequently for your diabetic patients. All of these are going to be put on a low dose lisinopril, and you will also find that a lot of your heart failure patients, the current guidelines suggest that everybody be placed on some version of the ACE inhibitor. What's unique about lisinopril is it has a very specific renal protection, and so it actually helps to protect renal function, which is part of why we want to make sure that all of our diabetic patients are on it, as well as our congestive heart failure patients, because we know that these conditions can be very hard on the kidneys. So when we look at our complications, we know that they have the risk of first dose orthostatic hypotension. And so for these patients, especially as they are beginning new therapies of ACE inhibitors, we want to make sure, that we are teaching them about what orthostatic hypotension is going to feel like, encouraging them to reposition slowly if they develop any dizziness, lightheadedness, to make sure that they lie down. A dry, non-productive cough is also a potential side effect or complication of ACE inhibitors. This is usually related to that inhibition of the kinase 2. And so we want to encourage our patients, if they are taking lisinopril and develop this dry, hacky cough, to notify the provider who will discontinue and put them on a different type of blood pressure medicine. Also, the hyperkalemia, we talked about how this is going to increase the excretion of sodium and water. And so by releasing that sodium and water, the concern is that we are increasing the concentration of potassium within the body. And so we want to make sure that we are monitoring for any manifestations of hyperkalemia. Remember, potassium heart. So we want to make sure that we're monitoring their heart. And then also, these patients can develop rash and altered taste. So again, notify your provider if those occur. Angioedema is probably one of the more common with lisinopril, especially angioedema. If you remember from your 310 content that is swelling of the tongue, as well as it can include the throat. And so we want to make sure that our patients know to report any initial swelling to stop the medication. And if it is bad enough, they will need to have additional treatment to help treat that angioedema. It can also cause some neutropenia. It's very rare, more common with your captopril. And so if you're going to administer the captopril, you want to make sure that you've looked, at their white blood counts and continue to monitor those while they're on the captopril. Contraindications, we would not want to give medications in the ACE inhibitor class to our pregnant or lactation. It is contraindicated as well to patients who have a history of that angioedema. We also want to be very cautious when we administer this to patients who have any type of renal impairment, but it is contraindicated if they have bilateral renal artery stenosis or if they only have a single kidney. It can cause entirely too much strain on a single kidney, or if they have that bilateral stenosis, then that is putting too much pressure on the kidneys. So contraindicated if you've got those bilateral renal artery stenosis or a single kidney, caution with any type of kidney impairment. Our interactions, obviously, if we put them on a diuretic, we understand that that can certainly worsen and put them at an increased risk for that first dose hypertension. Any type of antihypertensive medications along with this certainly would increase the risk for hypotension. Because of that concern for hyperkalemia, we discourage the use of potassium supplements as well as potassium sparing diuretics. Use those only if absolutely needed. And then lithium levels can be increased if they are taking this. And that is, remember, kind of the same effect with your potassium. If we're getting rid of the water and the sodium and it's leaving the body, then what's left floating in the blood, if you're taking lithium, it could become too concentrated. So we would have increased lithium levels. Also, the use of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories can decrease the therapeutic effect of ACE inhibitors. And so we want to be very cautious with concurrent use of NSAIDs and our ACE inhibitors. For our nursing administration, these are usually oral medications. The only one that is IV is the enalaprilate. And so the odd one that doesn't end in pril is the only one that can be used IV. These can be administered at home. Patients frequently take these as routine medications. And so some of the education that we need to encourage is especially for that first dose, monitoring for the orthostatic hypotension, making sure they understand those safety precautions to get up, change positions slowly. Notify the provider if they have the dry cough, if they begin to have any swelling, if they begin to have that altered taste. And so that is your ACE inhibitors. Moving on to your angiotensin II receptor blockers, these are going to be your TANs. This is your losartan, ibosartan, candesartan, olmesartan, telmisartan, valsartan. The TANs. If it ends in TAN, most likely it's an angiotensin II receptor blocker. These medications block the action of angiotensin II. Remember, we said that ACEs prevent angiotensin I from converting to angiotensin II. And so our angiotensin II receptor blockers block the action of angiotensin. Instead of blocking the conversion of it, we block the action of it. This results in vasodilatation and, again, the excretion of sodium and water. Okay, so these are going to have very similar side effects. It is used for the treatment of hypertension. Two of them, your valsartan and your candesartan, are also used to treat congestive heart failure. We use losartan to help prevent strokes. And then telmisartan is used to protect from heart attacks, strokes, and death from other cardiac events. When we're talking about our complications, we have some of those same complications as far as your hypotension, angioedema, the lightheadedness, dizziness, and this time we're including fetal injury. And so, you know, if our patient is of childbearing age, we should encourage them to use contraception while taking any of our angiotensin II blockers. It is contraindicated, obviously, for pregnancy and lactation, you know, especially the pregnancy with the fetal injury. And then same as our ACE, our bilateral renal stenosis, and our single kidney, it just puts too much pressure on the kidneys to release the sodium and the water. When we're looking at our interactions, we want to be careful when combining these with additional antihypertensives due to the risk for hypotension, and the same concept with our lithium toxicity. For our nursing administration, we do want to monitor for any type of hypotension. We also want to make sure that if we are using this medication for congestive heart failure, that we're monitoring daily weights, monitoring for edema, and fluid volume overload. Next, we're going to talk about our aldosterone antagonist. This is going to be our spironolactone. You remember we talked about this as a potassium-sparing diuretic, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here. But these medications also work as aldosterone agonists. They reduce the blood volume by blocking aldosterone receptors within the kidney and thus promoting the excretion of sodium and water. Y'all seeing the pattern here? And what is different about these medications is that they preserve potassium. And so they are used for the treatment of hypertension, congestive heart failure, premenstrual syndrome, your polycystic ovarian kidney disease, can also be used for acne in young females, and also hyperaldosteronism. When we're talking about our complications, you know, obviously if we're sparing our potassium, our concern is going to be hyperkalemia. If we are getting rid of sodium, we would be concerned about the risk for hyponatremia. These medications can cause what is known as flu-like manifestations. That's going to include some of your body aches, you know, headaches, fatigue, you know, just some of those general manifestations that we commonly associate with having the flu. It can cause endocrine changes such as gynecomastia, as well as menstrual irregularities, and then the dizziness and fatigue. It is contraindicated in patients who already have hyperkalemia. Remember, it is sparing potassium, and so we, you know, don't want to leave all that extra potassium in somebody who currently has elevated potassium levels. Can certainly, you know, cause increased workload on the kidneys, and so we want to be, you know, careful when we're using it with any type of kidney disease. This medication is excreted through hepatic, so we want to make sure that we're not using it in patients who have known liver disease. Also contraindicated for patients who have microalbuminuria, which is typically found in our type 2 diabetic patients. Some of the interactions, a lot of these you will see frequently. So your ACEs, your ARBs, erythromycin, potassium sparing diuretics, things like that, that already have a risk for increased hyperkalemia, certainly would also create an increased risk when used with aldosterone antagonist. The lithium toxicity, you may have already heard this, CYP3A4 is a liver enzyme. It's a protein that's made in the liver. And so as medications are absorbed or excreted, your CYP3A4s have a tendency to either encourage too much release or hold on. And so grapefruit and grapefruit juice is a very strong CYP3A4. So any medication that's got that CYP3A4 risk factor is going to include your grapefruit juice. And then also any concurrent use of diuretics would increase the risk for orthostatic hypotension. Nursing administration, we do not administer this with potassium supplements. It is potassium sparing, so we do not want to administer additional potassium for these patients. Next is your calcium channel blockers. These are going to be your nifedipine, verapamil, deltalazim, amlodipine, phelodipine, nicardipine. And so your calcium channel blockers, I've divided those up for you. The two that I want you to really, you know, focus on and be aware of are the ones that are the three that are in bold: nifedipine, verapamil, and deltalazim. These are going to be the ones that you're going to see most often used in the acute care setting. Amlodipine is very common. A lot of patients take that outpatient. But again, I want you to focus on the ones that you're actually going to use inpatient. So the purpose of nifedipine is to block the calcium channels that leads to vasodilation, as well as vascular smooth muscles and arterioles of the heart. And so it acts primarily on arteries. Veins are not significantly affected with your nifedipine. It's mostly acting on your arteries. Your verapamil and deltalazim, these are blocking the calcium channels as well, usually more so in the myocardial, which it by therefore affects the SA node, the AV nodes, and there's a whole scientific process that goes into these calcium channels and the effects. And so there's a couple of videos that I've watched on YouTube that show really good illustrations of these calcium channels and their effects on the body. So when we're looking at our complications, our nifedipine can cause reflex tachycardia, orthostatic hypotension. Your verapamil, deltalazim as well will cause that orthostatic hypotension. But they're also putting us at increased risk for your bradycardia as well as your dysrhythmias. And so when we're talking about contraindications, our nifedipine is contraindicated with any type of cardiogenic shock. Verapamil is going to be contraindicated with any heart blocks or severe CHF, as well as DIG toxicity. Your interactions, your nifedipine is going to interact with your beta blockers, and that is, your beta blockers are going to be such as metoprolol. Also, your cimetidine, ranitidine, as well as your grapefruit juice leads to toxicity, and that's because of that CYP3A4 enzyme that we were just talking about. Your verapamil and deltalazim can increase digoxin levels, and so increasing the risk of DIG toxicity. Concurrent use of beta blockers can lead to heart failure, AV block, as well as bradycardia. If you've got a beta blocker and you've got a calcium channel blocker, you're really putting your heart at increased risk to have those blocks where those electrocardiac impulses are not making its way through the conduction system. Nursing administration, we want to advise these clients not to chew or crush any sustained release tablets. For IV administration of verapamil, we want to make sure that it is administered slowly over a period of 2 to 3 minutes. And also teach your clients to monitor their blood pressure, their heart rate. We want to withhold this medication if at any point the pulse rate falls below 50 or the systolic blood pressure falls below 90. Advise them to change positions slowly because of that risk of orthostatic hypotension. So now let's talk specifically about the beta blockers. We kind of mentioned them just a minute ago in combination with your calcium channel blockers. But when we look at beta blockers, we have what's called cardioselective. These are beta ones. They only affect the heart. That's going to be metoprolol is the one we're going to talk about. You will see atenolol, not really esmolol very much. Your non-selective are going to affect both beta 1, beta 2, therefore affecting both the heart and the lungs. Most common is going to be your propranolol, but you will also see nadolol occasionally. And then you have what's called your alpha and beta blockers, and these are going to affect both alpha and beta 1, beta 2, and that's going to be your carvedilol. That's going to be your most common. Labetalol will be one that you may see if you work in the intensive care unit, but carvedilol is one that most patients take outpatient on a routine basis. The purpose of these drugs is to decrease the cardiac output. It does so by decreasing the heart rate. I don't know what decreases cardiac is supposed to mean over there. I think that was supposed to be decreases cardiac output. It is used in the treatment of hypertension, angina, any type of tachydysrhythmias, as well as heart failure, migraines, glaucoma. You know, beta blockers slow things down, including the heart rate. Complications of your metoprolol and propranolol is bradycardia. You can slow the heart rate down to the point where you have such a decrease in cardiac output that you're putting your patient at risk for hypoxia. Also with your propranolol, that one can also cause the bronchoconstriction. Remember, that's the one that's going to affect both your heart and lungs. Beta blockers are contraindicated in patients who have any type of atrial ventricular block. That's going to be your heart blocks, as well as sinus bradycardia. We don't want to slow the heart rate down if somebody who has an AV block or a sinus bradycardia. Your non-selective beta adrenergic blockers are also contraindicated for patients who have asthma bronchospasms. That's because of that effect they have on the lungs, as well as heart failure. And so anytime we have a patient who has any type of asthma, we want to make sure that we're giving them that cardioselective. We want them to be on the metoprolol. So when we're looking at interactions, we talked about just a minute ago, these beta blockers interact with your calcium channel blockers, and any concurrent use of antihypertensives could increase your risk for your hypotension. And then kind of the odd, interesting little fact down here about the propranolol. Propranolol actually will mask the hypoglycemic effect of insulin. So for your diabetic patients who are taking propranolol, you have to be very careful in monitoring their blood glucose levels, because the only way you're going to catch that hypoglycemia is by monitoring it. You're not going to see those typical cold and clammy, normal signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia. Your nursing administration, you want to advise your clients not to discontinue this medication without consulting with their provider. Monitor for safety with those orthostatic hypotension. Change positions slowly. You know, be aware of the dizziness. Encourage your patients to self-monitor their heart rate and their blood pressure at home, and preferably take this medication with food because it helps to increase absorption of the medication. Your cardiac glycosides, this is going to be your digoxin. This increases the force of the myocardial contraction. It improves the pump's effectiveness. It decreases the heart rate. So when you think about it, it's the way we've always been taught it is it slows and strengthens. It slows the heart rate down, but it also strengthens the contraction of the heart. It is used for patients who are experiencing both heart failure as well as atrial fibrillation. Complications can include dysrhythmias as well as cardiotoxicity. It can cause nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, anorexia, fatigue, weakness. Vision change is probably going to be one of your first signs of toxicity with your cardiac glycosides. Contraindicated with any type of ventricular dysrhythmia. And then we want to use caution in our patients who have AV blocks, heart failures, and hypokalemia. Your interactions, your diuretics such as hydrochlorothiazide, your loop diuretics such as furosemide can lead to significant hypokalemia and increase the risk of developing those dysrhythmias. We want to also use caution with our ACEs and ARBs because of the risk of hyperkalemia. Interestingly enough, your antacids actually decrease the absorption of digoxin. And so we want to educate our patients not to take antacids concurrently with their digoxin to spread those out. Your nursing administrations, we want to make sure that patients are taking this medication as prescribed. We need to maintain that therapeutic level. And we also need to avoid toxicity. So if they do miss a dose, we need to make sure they are aware that they do not need to double the next dose to make up for any missed doses. We want to make sure that we're educating the patient to check their rate and rhythm prior to taking their digoxin. As nurses, we want to do that for them anytime we are in the hospital and administering that medication. So if our heart rate falls below 60, We want to hold that medication, notify the provider. We really encourage them to take this at the same time each day. That helps to maintain those therapeutic blood levels. We want to monitor those levels. Again, I don't necessarily need you to memorize the normals. Just know that we would monitor to prevent any DIG toxicity. If you're administering IV digoxin, we want to make sure that we infuse it over at least 5 minutes, preferably 10 to 15 minutes for anybody who has pulmonary edema, and monitor for dysrhythmia. So we want to make sure that they're going to be on the cardiac monitor while they're taking this medication. Next medication we're going to talk about is your adrenergic agonist. This is going to include your epinephrine, your norepinephrine, dopamine, dobutamine. These are medications that are most frequently used in the ICU setting. The purpose of your epi and norepi is vasoconstriction. It increases blood pressure by causing that vasoconstriction and lowering or increasing peripheral resistance. We also occasionally use that to slow peripheral bleeding. If we make the veins and arteries in the periphery smaller, we would anticipate to have less bleeding from any peripheral bleeding. Your dobutamine increases the heart rate, the myocardial contractility, basically leading to an increased cardiac output. It is used more frequently in your heart failure patients. So complications that can arise from taking this. Epinephrine can certainly cause hypertensive crisis as well as your dysrhythmias. And then your norepinephrine and your dopamine can cause significant necrosis. This is because of that IV administration. If it becomes extravasated, it will cause the vasoconstriction to the point where it actually causes necrosis of the adjacent tissues. Dopamine is contraindicated for patients who have any tachycardia or tachydysrhythmias, as well as ventricular fibrillation. Your epinephrine should be used with caution in clients who already have any type of hyperthyroidism, angina, dysrhythmias, as well as hypertension. Interactions, we want to be very cautious administering with general anesthetics because it can cause the heart to become hypersensitive to the effects of the epinephrine and the dobutamine. This comes into play with your trauma patients. And so if we've got a patient who has come in with a significant trauma and we're trying to maintain a blood pressure, so we administer these medications to maintain a blood pressure, and then they end up going to surgery. We just need to make sure that the surgeon and the anesthetic providers are aware that they have been on that adrenergic agonist. These medications must be administered by IV through a continuous infusion. We want to make sure that they are on an IV pump. This is not one that you're going to free flow or gravity flow. The dosage is titrated based on the blood pressure response. And so, you know, if the goal blood pressure that we're trying to achieve for our trauma patients is, you know, systolic of greater than 110, then once we hit 110, we would begin to titrate down these medications. If the blood pressure holds at that level, then we can continue to titrate down. If the blood pressure begins to fall, we would have to reinitiate that initial titration and go back up. We want to stop the infusion of dopamine at the first evidence of any infiltration. Remember, we said that extravasation can cause necrosis. And so we want to be sure, not to sacrifice an arm because we've let an infusion extravasate into the arm. Monitor for chest pain, monitor your kidney output, monitor your EKGs. Next, we're going to talk about your organic nitrites. This is going to be your nitroglycerin or isosorbide. What these do is create an increased venous return through dilating the veins. It decreases the cardiac oxygen demand, treats the acute angina, and also can be used as prophylactic for chronic stable angina or variant angina. complications. Most of the time when you administer nitroglycerin, the first thing the patient's going to tell you is they've developed a headache. That's how you know that the medicine is working. We need to be very careful when administering nitroglycerin because of the risk for orthostatic hypotension. We want these patients to be on bed rest while they're taking these nitroglycerins inpatient, especially with your IV administration. We want to monitor for reflex tachycardia, and our patients who are on it for chronic angina, it can eventually cause tolerance where the medication is no longer effective. We want to be careful for patients who have any closed angle glaucoma or traumatic head injuries. They should not be taking this medication. For your interactions, please be aware that patients who are on PDE5 inhibitors, that's going to be your sildenafil, tadalafil, and vernafil, used for most commonly for erectile dysfunction, they cannot be on nitroglycerin because it can result in life-threatening hypotension. The use of alcohol is also contraindicated for our patients who are on nitroglycerin, and we need to be very careful with the antihypertensive because it can significantly increase the risk of hypotension. Nursing administration using the rapid acting nitrate is the first indication of chest pain. And so I'm sure in your med-surg classes, you've learned of MONA, which stands for morphine, oxygen, nitroglycerin, and aspirin. So at the first sign of chest pain, we do administer sublingual nitroglycerin for that vasodilation to decrease the workload of the heart. For patients who have chronic angina, we can advise them to take this medication prior to exertion. And we should also make sure our patients know to store these tablets and bottles in a cool, dark place. The bottles are usually a very dark color to help reduce exposure to light. All right, next we're going to talk about our antidysrhythmics. We've got several. Our classification includes our sodium channel blockers, beta adrenergic blockers, our potassium channel blockers, and our calcium channel blockers. We've already talked about most of these. There's only just a few that are going to be new. That's our sodium channel and our potassium channel. And so I've broke them down, class 1, class 2, class 3, class 4, and your miscellaneous. And so each one of them have a very distinct mechanism of action. So your sodium channel blockers are going to block the sodium channel, which delays the electrical conduction. It's used more for ventricular dysrhythmias. Your class 2 is going to be your propranolol. That's going to decrease your heart rate as well as your ectopic stimulation. That's going to be used for your atrial fib, atrial flutter, your SVT. Can also be used for hypertension, angina, and intermittent PVCs. Class 3, okay, that's going to be your amiodarone. That's your potassium channel blocker. It's going to delay repolarization, which basically prolongs the action potential, reducing both contractility and conduction. And that's going to be used for your AFib, A-flutter, your VFib, and your VTAC. Your class 4 is going to be your calcium channel. We talked about that. That's your diltiazem. It decreases the heart rate and the force of the contraction. That's going to be your AFib, A-flutter, your SVT, hypertension, and angina. The two miscellaneous includes adenosine and digoxin. So adenosine is going to be used for your SVT and your Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. Digoxin is going to be used for your heart failure, AFib, A-flutter, and SVT. All right, complications. Your class ones, let me get back on my highlighter. Let me pick a different color. Let's go yellow. Okay. So for your class ones, you know, our concern with your lidocaine. So your class one, that's your sodium. Our concern is going to be respiratory arrest. If you're administering lidocaine IV, your concern is developing respiratory arrest. Your class two drugs, that's going to be the ones we're going to watch out for, those bronchospasms and asthma. Your class three, that's going to be your pulmonary toxicity as well as your phlebitis. And then your class four, we're worried about the bradycardia, the hypotension. For adenosine, our concern is the sinus bradycardia as well as the hypotension. And then your digoxin, we're worried about the toxicity. Contraindications, I've provided you the contraindications there. I'm not going to focus on those for your antidysrhythmics. I'm not going to focus on the interactions. What I want you to really pay attention to is your nursing administration for each of them. All right, so for your class one, IV administration is usually started with a loading dose, which is weight-based, and then followed by a maintenance dose. You're going to adjust according to the response, and they're usually on this medication for no more than 24 hours, okay? So for your class two, you want to make sure that it is run no faster than 1 milligram per minute. Amiodarone is highly toxic. You're going to monitor for those adverse events. Your loading dose, it comes in a 25 milligram vial, but most of the time you're going to start it at a 12.5 milligrams IV push over 2 minutes. It must be over 2 minutes. You cannot slam amiodarone. Once you have administered your initial IV push over 2 minutes, you will then begin to start a titration, which is anywhere going to be anywhere between 5 and 25 mics. And then that titration will run until you have received the therapeutic event or therapeutic effect that you're looking for. Your class four, you want to monitor your heart rate before. You want to hold it if it's anything less than 50. And then for your miscellaneous, your adenosine has a very short half-life. This adenosine is the one that you're going to you're slamming it. You're slamming it in. As fast as you can push it, you're going to push it. Because the whole purpose is to stop the heart rate so that it, when it kicks back in and restarts, it starts back on a regular rhythm. Because of that short half-life, because you got to slam it to get the effect you want, it also wears off very quickly. So any adverse events that you have, they're not going to last any more than a minute. Digoxin, you want to check your apical pulse for 1 minute before administering it and encourage the patient to take or to eat a high potassium diet. All right, last, statins. Atorvastatin, simvastatin, lovastatin, pravastatin, rosuvastatin, fluvastatin, pitavastatin, okay? Statin is a statin, okay? Those should be pretty easy to identify when you see them. The purpose is to decrease the manufacture of LDL and VLDL cholesterol. It increases the manufacture of HDL. Remember, your HDL is your good cholesterol, your LDL and your VLDL is your bad cholesterol. These medications are used for the treatment of primary hypercholesterolemia, as well as the prevention of coronary events and coronary or cerebrovascular accidents. Complications, these medications are hepatotoxic. So we need to monitor for liver disease, okay? It is contraindicated for patients who already have liver disease. We know that it can cause liver injury, and so we want to monitor our patient's liver as they're taking their statin. The most common adverse event that we see with our statins is myopathy, and it's usually leg pain. Patients will report after taking statins that they have significant bilateral leg pain. Statins are also contraindicated in our patients who are breastfeeding. Interactions, if we take it with the fibrates, it can increase the risk of myopathy. These are also very strong CYP3A4 suppressants, and so we want to be careful when we're administering them with either grapefruit juice or any of the other medications that are thrown that are very strong CYP3A4 inhibitors. Administer lovastatin with the evening meal. All the others can be taken without food. However, we do encourage evening dosing because cholesterol is synthesized as we sleep. We want to maintain adequate monitoring of these patients, not only their cholesterol levels, but their liver functions and kidney functions during treatment. All right, that is the end of your cardiovascular. I know I talked fast and I went through it, but that's a lot to cover, trying to keep your time down.